attention spans can be short. Before Iran, there was Venezuela, but before Venezuela, there was Gaza. Last October, a ceasefire ended the most violent stage of a conflict that had begun 2 years earlier and in which tens of thousands of people had died. Big plans were supposed to emerge for Gaza's reconstruction and future government, and involving Donald Trump's new Board of Peace. So, turning our attention back to Gaza, what's happened with that? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, to get an update on what the situation is right now for Gazans, I'm joined by the BBC's Gaza correspondent, Rushdie Abualouf, who's now based in Istanbul. Rushdie, looking at the situation in Gaza right now, where are the people actually living?
Well, they still live in the same place as when the ceasefire was announced, because there was no further Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. And all of the people in Gaza, about 2 million people, they live in the area controlled by Hamas in the western side of Gaza, because about 53% of what is called behind the yellow line are controlled by Israel, and very few people, they still live in that area. They belong to a militia backed by Israel, but the majority of the population, they live in the western side of Gaza. Mainly half of them, they live in tents and makeshift houses.
Now, last time we spoke to you back in October, you said there was at that point no running water. Is that still the case?
Well, it is still the case. And the majority of the population, the 95% of the population, they have to buy drinking water every day. And also they don't have water at all. So they have to buy water for other purposes, for cleaning the places or having a shower. So we will have to buy water, because there is no running water in Gaza.
What about electricity, Rushdie?
Well, the 95% of the electricity network was destroyed, according to the company that is provide the service in Gaza. Now there is a few people who are trying to make money out of this crisis by selling the electricity. But 1 kilowatt of electricity would cost you $10 to $12. Most of the people in Gaza, they don't have electricity. The people do have small solar panel. They can charge their phones, but no real electricity, no lighting in the house, nothing is functioning normally in their houses.
Is there any sign of proper rebuilding of houses?
There is no reconstruction going on at all in Gaza. The plan is for this new committee is to allow some building material. They said there is about 10% of the destroyed building can be repaired and can give some capacity to be able to stay in these buildings, but they need building material to be allowed by Israel first to be able to start the process of rebuilding.
Rushdie, how are people surviving? Firstly, what's the food situation like?
Well, it is very hard. I mean, most people rely on aid. The food situation is much, much better than the during the war. Israel allowed more aid into Gaza. It is affected since the war in Iran, because for the first week, Israel shut the crossings and they did not allow food. So there is a shortage of food. And when they resumed allowing in food again, it was just half of capacity of what's used to be allowed before the war. So the prices are getting up. Yes, of course, there is people are, you know, struggling to get food and medicine and water. It's a daily struggle, but nothing near the time when the Gaza was close to a famine.
Now, who is in charge in Gaza? Who actually runs things? Are there police forces? Is there a health ministry?
Well, I mean, the entire system is collapsed. Hamas is trying since the October, when the ceasefire went into effect, they straight away started to enforce their power on the ground, regroup, restructure their, security apparatus. But they have been hit hard by Israel during the war, and Israel continue to hit Hamas every day, every day. Last night there was an airstrike killing 2 policemen. A day before there was another airstrike killing another police people. But we have seen at least 60 people were killed within the last 2 weeks. Most of them are Hamas police officers.
Rushdie Abualouf. Next, to find out where we've got to with President Trump's 20-point peace plan, I'm joined by Anshul Pfeffer, who's Israel correspondent at The Economist. Anshul Pfeffer, without going through all the points of the 20-point peace plan, can you just remind us what the main provisions were?
There were a number of stages. The first stage, which was the initial ceasefire and an agreement that Hamas would release the Israeli hostages and bodies of hostages that it still had in return for a release of hundreds of Palestinian prisoners and the resumption of humanitarian convoys into Gaza. So those three things already happened 6 months ago. And ever since, we've been on some kind of trajectory, unclear quite the pace of it, towards the next stage, which is supposed to be the arrival of the Palestinian technocratic government to Gaza, the beginning of the disarmament of Hamas, a withdrawal of Israel from an unspecified part of the half of Gaza which it currently controls, and the beginning of some kind of rebuilding, reconstruction of the ruins, most of Gaza, which is now in ruins. As a future stage, another Israeli withdrawal. Ultimately, Israel's supposed to withdraw to the border between Gaza and Israel, not control any of Gaza. That's currently very much in the distant future.
Right, let's go back to this technocratic committee. I'm going to dig into this a little bit more later, but just remind us what this committee is supposed to do, who's on it, and where they are.
These are Palestinian officials, people who have served in previous Palestinian administrations, mainly civilian experts. They're supposed to run all the civilian aspects of life in Gaza, health, education, food, etc. They are still stuck in Egypt because even though Israel has opened the Rafah crossing between Egypt and Israel, currently the movement through it is very limited. I think right now it's mainly closed since the war began in Iran. But even when it was open before the war in Iran, maybe a few dozen people passed through it every day. And these were largely people who needed medical treatment outside of Gaza, and if a really small number of people being allowed to return. So far, that doesn't include the technocratic government.
Now, President Trump formed this famous Board of Peace to oversee the peace process. Can you remind us what it is, this Board of Peace, who's on it, and what's it supposed to be doing?
There's various levels of the Board of Peace. Starting from the very top, it's sort of a leaders club that Donald Trump is trying to set up. He wants world leaders, presidents and prime ministers and kings to be part of some global Board of Peace. This is not just for Gaza. This is basically Trump's ego trip platform. So this is some kind of UN bypass Donald Trump managed forum. There were supposed to be conditions that every member would pay $1 billion to be part of it. A number of presidents and prime ministers have signed up, but I don't think any of them are major countries. They've had one meeting in Washington, but it didn't seem to have done very much. But this is Donald Trump's Board of Peace. In other words, it's some kind of unclear forum. The only thing we know about it that he runs the show, and the founding charter actually allows him to run it in perpetuity. So perhaps even after he's no longer the president of the United States. Then there's the second level is of the Board of Peace for Gaza. There you do have some people who may be able to do things, the ex-Prime Minister of Britain, Tony Blair, and others. There's another executive council beneath that, which is specifically supposed to oversee the technocratic government. So you've got four levels of management. But right now, you know, it's just a list of names and people who have agreed to serve. They're not there. They're not doing very much. There is some kind of coordination going on behind the scenes. But until they can actually get into Gaza, they're currently a board without any real powers and without even any real presence.
Anshul Pfeffer. And before we move on, a reminder about the Briefing Room podcast. If you visit BBC Sounds, you can find the entire back catalogue, such as the recent one which asks why youth unemployment is so high, and further back, the one which asks what the UK can learn from the rest of Europe about asylum reform. Now, back to Gaza and its future. I'm joined by Tahani Mustafa, who's a lecturer in international relations in the Department of War Studies at King's College London. Aaron David Miller, who's Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in the US, and Anshul Pfeffer, who is still with us. Tahani Mustafa, one of the things we've not talked about, really, is the role that Palestinians are playing in this peace process. Anshul mentioned this committee of Palestinians. Could you just tell us a bit more about them? Who are they? Where do they come from? Who's running them?
So it's meant to be a 16 to 17 person technocratic committee, as the name implies, which means that this committee has absolutely no political substance to it. In terms of their mandate, it really is very much reduced to service provision, things like health, sanitation, education. Right now, we do have most members that have been agreed upon, appointed, and also vetted by the Israelis. But unfortunately, they still haven't been able to actually access the Gaza Strip. And a lot of the reconstruction is very much predicated on their entry into and then administration of the Strip. Now, the committee itself is meant to consist of quote-unquote independent technocrats. Many of these individuals are, in fact, you know, technocrats. They come from various different backgrounds. Some of them have previously served in ministerial positions, like Ali Shaath, who's
heading the Palestinian Authority.
Yes. So Ali Shaath is heading the National Technocratic Committee. There are others who are, you know, businessmen. Some of them come from an NGO background. Most are from Gaza. Some are sort of Gaza in terms of ID holders. They come from Gaza, but they've lived the majority of their lives, especially professional lives in Ramallah, including people like Ali Shaath. They are currently operating from Egypt. And right now, in terms of even payroll, you know, they're very much being paid by the UAE.
Just to be clear, none of these people are affiliated either to Hamas or actually to the political factions in the Palestinian Authority.
On paper, they're not meant to be. They are not, in fact, affiliated to Hamas, but they are affiliated to a particular individual from one of the Fatah splinter groups who currently now resides within the UAE and has been pivotal in a lot of these sort of negotiation processes around the Board of Peace and its implementation.
Aaron David Miller, given your experience, do you have any confidence in these structures to actually be able to achieve anything?
No, I have no confidence that these structures, that's not how negotiations work anyway. You don't negotiate through a board of peace. You don't negotiate through executive committees. Unless you had a real commitment from the president of the United States, who might be able, he has extraordinary leverage to induce the Israeli prime minister to take this 20-point plan seriously and to move from phase one to phase two. And then, of course, you confront the incredibly complex problem of a Palestinian national movement now that is divided, dysfunctional. If you had will, I could see turning some of these structures into actual instruments of implementation. But right now, no, I don't think there's going to be much progress on the ground.
Right. So that's an overall kind of pessimistic picture. Before we go further on that, Tahani, can you remind us about what's supposed to be happening with the peacekeepers? In other words, the peacekeeping force that, if any of this were to progress, would have to enter Gaza?
Well, that's been a point of contention, especially around the Board of Peace and its mandate. And that was really where a lot of the states that tried to provide any buy-in into the Board of Peace were trying to push for some kind of mandate, especially when it came to the ISF or International Stabilization Force that it was supposed to implement. And this force wasn't really a peacekeeping force per se. It's meant to be a force that provides law and order on the ground and is involved in some process of disarmament or decommissioning, whichever you end up coming to an agreement to. Now, a lot of states have been reluctant, as I said, to provide troops or backing to this simply because it still hasn't attained any kind of serious UN mandate for it. But beyond that, there's been no serious sort of execution of plans. And that's been quite frustrating for a lot of states that are willing to put support and backing into this.
States such as?
Indonesia. Arab states are very reluctant at this point in time, simply because with the way things are now, to implement or to have any kind of ISF force go in would be looking like, one, they're coming off the backs of Israeli tanks. Two, you have no assurances as to whether Israel is actually going to withdraw. And three, the fact that, you know, there's absolutely really nothing on the ground to do beyond disarm Hamas. If you're talking about reconstruction and law and order, I mean, exactly where is that going to be implemented?
Anshul, this takes us to the question of decommissioning. And before I come on to Aaron about this, can you tell me from the Israeli perspective, what does decommissioning Hamas mean?
Well, it very much depends on who you speak to on the Israeli side. There are any number of definitions of what that could be. Does it mean that Hamas turn in their personal weapons, their their rifles and pistols and just the light shoulder mounted missiles that they have. These are just the very basic of their weapons, and this is not the real threat to Israel. Israel's much more interested in dismantling Hamas rocket launchers and the workshops and places where they build and store those missiles. And then there's a question of the entire Hamas infrastructure when it comes to hundreds of miles of tunnels beneath Gaza. Now, obviously, Israel's current position is a maximalist one. And until everything is dismantled, all the light weapons, all the rockets, the rocket infrastructure and the tunnel networks, until that is destroyed, then there can be no talk of Hamas having been disarmed and Israel leaving the parts of the Gaza Strip that it controls. Now, everyone knows that all of that is not going to happen, but both for political and for security reasons, Israel won't address at this point some kind of arrangement in the middle. And until Trump enforces such a deal, then I don't think it's going to happen.
Aaron, some of our older listeners and one of our older presenters remembers what decommissioning meant in the case of Northern Ireland. Can you remind us what kind of a process it actually is?
Look, it took, in the wake of the Good Friday Agreement, 1998, it took until 2005 for decommissioning to take place. And decommissioning was tethered, unlike it is now, to the issue of legitimate participation of governance between the paramilitaries. That's not what's envisioned here. Hamas has not offered a role in governance of Gaza. In fact, decommissioning, demilitarization, understandably, is designed to show Hamas the exit, to say the least.
Tahani, have there been any very recent discussions with Hamas about decommissioning?
Well, there's currently a proposal now that they are considering that was put forward by the Board of Peace, which uses the term decommissioning, but in effect, what it is effectively requesting is the Israeli maximalist objective of total disarmament. So it's not just Hamas handing over its offensive weaponry, but also small pistols. And right now, I think Hamas haven't really given an answer. They're still considering the proposal. They're trying to put forward their own sort of clauses, including trying to attain assurances. One substantial one of which is assurances that Israel will not revert back to open warfare, nor will it attack Gaza in the future. And I think the proposal is, in terms of the time frame that is being offered, this process needs to be completed within an 8-month time frame, which again hasn't been the point of contention. I think the point of contention for Hamas has largely been the lack of guarantees from the Israeli side.
Aaron David Miller, can we look at what Israel has been doing to shore up its security position with regard to Gaza, and whether or not its security stance has gone through a major change as a consequence of the last 2 years?
Yeah, look, my view is that the Israelis essentially, in the wake of October 7th, have redefined what security really means. It's no longer a matter of prevention or preemption. And Gaza is part of a pattern. The broader issue is the Israelis seem to have concluded that operating inside on a relatively permanent basis of the territory of their adversaries is a new and broader dimension of their security. You see it in Gaza, where even under the best of circumstances, the yellow line, the satellite imagery is extraordinary, the degree to which the Israelis are hardening their military positions along that yellow line. In Lebanon, the Israelis, quite to my surprise, seem to be repeating the notion of establishing a security zone.
You're saying to your surprise because they've done it before and it didn't work.
Exactly. Lebanon has been such an unhappy story for them, and nothing has worked. And by the way, I think Hamas is prepared to surrender governance. All that's done is to diminish their prestige, but I don't believe they are prepared, barring some settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that creates a Palestinian state, to give up their role as the preeminent decision maker on matters relating to Gaza's security reconstruction, which is critically important to them, in the 47% of Gaza that they control.
Let's look at the impact of the American-Israeli war with Iran on all this. Tahani, has this affected the attitude of, say, Gulf states and other Arab states towards the Gaza process?
Well, certainly, I think the concern now is with the tensions shifted and obviously with the impact this war is now having on the Gulf states, especially economically, that this is going to end up shifting where their priorities now lie, especially in the way of not just diplomatic attention that they will be affording this, but also, more importantly, the economic support that they have previously pledged but now may not be able to actually fulfill. So certainly there is a concern now that this is definitely going to shift the priorities of those Gulf states.
Aaron, what do you think the impact's been?
I hate to be so negative about this, but look, the three reasons people cared about Gaza to begin with: Israel's terrifyingly effective and ferocious campaign to prosecute its war against Hamas and the scores of thousands of Palestinian civilians who were killed in the process. That's been diffused, not ended. Number two is hostages. That's gone. And number three is reports of starvation and famine. The situation in Gaza is not good. Food insecurity, shelter is a huge problem. But the international community, once those three things have been sort of diffused, and I don't want to trivialize them, the question is, even before you got to Iran, whether or not there is the will on the part of, forget the vaunted international community, I think, frankly, they've proven themselves to be useless. But with respect to the core decision makers, I don't see a whole lot of purpose and will in the Trump administration's view. And now they are in a monumental regional distraction, which, even if it ended tomorrow, is going to create certain new realities that will continue to refocus their attentions. The Gulf states, already skeptical about investing billions of dollars in Gaza only to have it consumed and whatever they've reconstructed, consumed in yet another Israeli-Hamas confrontation, they're going to be very wary and unfocused.
Anshul, the impression I'm getting from all this is one of a gigantic kicking of the can down the road on Gaza. So I'm just going to make a brief summary of what I think I'm hearing so far, really, which is, as long as the Gazans are fed, as long as there aren't thousands of people still being killed, as long as other things are distracting us, then the Israelis and other people will live with what's going on at the moment.
This was an explosive can being kicked down the road by all, you know, everyone involved for over 75 years. It's always been, we only talk about or notice Gaza when things blow up. And right now, since much bigger things are blowing up and there are other larger conflicts happening in the region, then Gaza will once again be disregarded for who knows how long, until something blows up again there. It's just convenient for the world to focus on other things, and that will remain the situation, I fear.
I want to look at something that might be consequential in all this in the future, which is public opinion in both Israel and in America. Aaron David Miller, it seems to the observer that public opinion in America on the question of its support for Israel in these circumstances is shifting, and that that might be a factor going forward. Is that a realistic thought?
It is shifting. I think Israel's brand, to say the least, has been blackened in a way that I've never seen it. I've watched the U.S.-Israeli relationship under both Rehok and the Democratic administrations. I don't think support for Israel has ever been less robust. The polls bear that out. The question, of course, is whether public attitudes will and can translate into the level of political elites.
Anshul, a similar sort of question with regard to Israel. I don't know what degree of importance Gaza will play in the Israeli election. And I don't know, and maybe you can tell us, how different results in the Israeli election might have an impact on the future of Gaza.
The upcoming Israeli election campaign, we don't yet have a definite date, but the election will probably be in October, will be very much a referendum on whether Netanyahu is to blame for October 7, which is now, by now, 2.5 years ago. Netanyahu has tried to move the narrative along and claim that he has since scored incredible victories over Hamas in Gaza and over Hezbollah in Lebanon and now over Iran. And that will be his campaign. He'll say, I've changed the map of the Middle East and I am Donald Trump's senior partner in a war. And the other side will be saying, you're the one who is responsible for Israel's worst tragedy, worst failure in at least 50 years, if not in Israel's entire existence. So that will be very much a focus of the campaign. I don't see that much changing immediately, even if Netanyahu loses the election, because these security dilemmas that Israel has in Gaza, in the West Bank, with Lebanon, with Iran, will still remain. Assuming Netanyahu does lose, whoever replaces him will have to deal with them and also have to show the Israeli public that they can be just as tough as Netanyahu's.
Aaron David Miller.
I continue to believe, maybe I shouldn't, I was at the last, in my judgment, most serious effort where an American president brought an empowered Israeli prime minister and a Palestinian leader who had legitimacy and decision-making authority to Camp David in July of 2000. That was 26 years ago. And the gaps on the five core issues, border security, refugees, Jerusalem, and end of all conflict and claims were as wide as the Grand Canyon, and nothing that I've seen in the last 26 years has done anything more than to make them galactic in how difficult it's going to be to bring Israelis and Palestinians together. You give me an Israeli leader who is serious about this, a Palestinian leader who has control, one gun, one authority, one negotiating position, and a U.S. president that's willing to see this through. And yeah, I got kids and grandkids. I'm not willing to give up on the possibility that you actually can find a solution to what to do with the 15 million humans that live between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River. You can still do this, but it is going to require a level of leadership that, frankly, we've never seen. And that's a very heavy lift.
Tahani, a last word from you.
I mean, I think in theory, I'd certainly agree with that. But unfortunately, the political will just simply isn't there. You have neither the leadership from the Israeli nor Palestinian side, and worse yet, neither the political will externally to be, I mean, if we are to see any serious substantive positive change in this conflict, it needs to come from outside. It cannot come from internally from either societies right now. Neither the Israelis are there nor the Palestinians.
That's all we've got time for. My thanks to Tahani Mustafa, Anshul Pfeffer, Aaron David Miller and Rushdi Abu Alouf. And my conclusion doesn't look hopeful, does it? We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye.
A group of men ran in with machetes.
I'm Livy Haydock, and from BBC Sounds and BBC Radio 5 Live, this is Gangster. The story of Georgie Pye.
The scene of the killing near a Chinese bookshop is being flooded with detectives.
Welcome to the world of the triads.
If the triads are coming out of you, you're done.
Where loyalty is sworn in blood. Gangster, the story of Georgie Pye. Listen first on BBC Sounds.